Right, thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is April 26, 2022. I'm Louise Bjorkman. I am joined this morning on the panel by Chief Judge Siegel and Judge Bratfold. This is the third case on our calendar for oral argument this morning. It is the State of Minnesota versus DeAndre Cush. Counsel, I know you are both very familiar with our procedures. You will each have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. And I will note that this proceeding may not be recorded pursuant to our rules. So with that, counsel for appellant, Mr. Whithall, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Eric Whithall. I'm an attorney with the Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear on behalf of the appellant, DeAndre Cush. Your Honors, today we've raised two issues. The first is concerning the revocation of 28 statutory maximum sentences from probation. And the second issue concerns the application of the career offender statute, which was used to enhance the sentences in all 28 cases to the statutory maximum. So the first issue that I'd like to start with concerns the revocation of Mr. Cush's probation. And under Motland, the district courts are required to make certain findings under what's known commonly as Austin factors. So in this case, narrowly, the district court recited the Austin/Motland factors. The problem that we've identified is the fact that the court's factual findings do not satisfy and at least in a material instance, directly conflict with the Austin factors the court relied on for revocation. Chiefly, the district court identified the Austin sub-factor to the need for confinement factor that reinstatement would unduly depreciate the seriousness of the violation itself. And in the same breath, the district court is identifying that Mr. Cush's violation for failing to ask permission before traveling outside of the state of Minnesota was a technical violation. The district court identified this repeatedly.
I want to stop you on this notion of a violation being technical. The fact that some violation is technical doesn't necessarily mean it's minor, does it?
Well, there's two reasons why a technical violation is not a serious violation. The first is the statute that I said in my brief. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think we agree that the statute defines technical violation as a non-criminal violation. So when we're talking about the spectrum of severity, that's the first way of looking at it. Hey, this we know it's not a serious violation in the sense that it doesn't violate the law. It's not a criminal violation. And the second is the way the court identifies what the violation conduct is, that it's not the fact that he left the state that the court was concerned about. The court's findings identify the fact that he didn't ask permission first.
But isn't that the point of probation, is to be subject to a probation officer's ability to set parameters? And, you know, here there was hardly, I mean, he'd been on probation how long when this happened? I mean, the fact that you can't do the, as the district court said, the easy part, which is let the probation officer know that this situation has come up and ask for permission, isn't that the heart of being on probation?
The heart of being on probation, identified in Austin and Motland, chiefly concerns rehabilitation and also ensuring the safety of the public. So the concern here of putting the failure to get permission doesn't align with the goals of probation as identified by our state Supreme Court. So if the issue in this case arising from Mr. Cush's travel outside of the state of Minnesota resulted in missing meetings with his agent, not participating in rehabilitative programming, or worse, absconding from absconding or evading supervision, I think that would be...
Wasn't he evading supervision? I mean, he knew he wasn't supposed to leave the state. He knew he was supposed to be on a GPS bracelet. The district court judge, in fact, asked him, like, do you think your probation officer would have said it's okay? I mean, this guy, engaged in quite a crime spree over a year. Tell me why the judge does find that if he leaves the state, first thing he does when he gets out of jail, that there's nothing else probation can do to really effectively supervise him. Now, I suppose they could have stuck the GPS bracelet on him right away, and that might have helped, but, you know, that's a snafu. But nevertheless, he was clearly told, don't leave the state, and you're going to be on a GPS. So at any rate, so why is that not enough to satisfy the third Austin factor? Just saying, we've got a guy who doesn't appreciate the seriousness of what he did, the harm he caused, you know, the financial harm he caused all these businesses. You know, no sooner does he get out than he's gone. I mean, he doesn't commit another crime. But so why is that finding not enough?
He doesn't commit another crime. He doesn't miss a meeting with his probation officer. He doesn't even miss court. You know, the record in this case is really clear that the day the warrant is issued is the same day that Mr. Cush subjects himself to being taken into custody. So there's, I don't want to minimize the significance of violating a pretty obvious condition of probation. Don't leave the state without first getting permission. It's the permission that the district court is really honing in on here. And the problem with the court relying on the permission aspect of it, and that you should have known and you should have been on GPS and you're really on a short leash, it doesn't support revocation under the third Austin factor, because that's relevant to the second Austin factor. This is where the court is identifying that by defying my order, defying what I told you, you left the state. If we had contested the second Austin factor here, the state and this court would say, well, it's obvious he violated the second Austin factor, the intentional and inexcusable, because he was told don't leave the state, because he was told he was supposed to be on GPS. He was told he was supposed to be on a short leash. This goes to the second factor about whether the violation was intentional or inexcusable. And to apply the same fact twice and say, because your violation was intentional and inexcusable, your probation must be therefore revoked, that is not what the third Austin factor looks at. The third Austin factor looks at factors relevant to rehabilitation and public safety, not whether the failure to get permission before traveling is contumacious, whether it impacts the court's perception that he's defying the court's direct orders. The court says, you basically flipped me the bird. This is about the court's perception of its authority over probationers rather than Mr. Cush's behavior that jeopardizes the goals of probation, which is to supervise him. He's not hooked up to GPS because he evaded being hooked up from the GPS. It's because probation didn't hook him up before he was released from jail. He didn't miss any probation meetings because he wasn't directed to come into the probation office until a certain date, 2 weeks after he was taken into custody. That's when he was supposed to meet with his probation officer. So, number one, this court should really narrow its review of the third Austin factor to what the district court said. The district court said that the violation was technical. The district court said that the violation was based on his failure to get permission. And I think there's also some greater concerns about the reasons why the district court revoked Mr. Cush's probation under these circumstances to send a message to other probationers. And
isn't that just another way of saying that failure to respond by revocation would depreciate the significance of the violation? Isn't that just another way of, I know you don't like the district court's words, but isn't that another way of saying just that?
I think that's another way of simply restating the third sub-factor for unduly depreciating. That's correct. And Motland is very clear. And this quote is pretty important for Motland. Courts should not assume that they have satisfied Austin by reciting the three factors and offering general, non-specific reasons for revocation. So if the court says this violation is serious, therefore you're getting revoked, and also it's serious and therefore you're getting revoked, just restating that sub-factor is not providing a specific reason, which is expressly required under the Motland decision. So we're talking, you know, if the court just simply restates the sub-factor, the court is not actually providing a factual basis. The court needs to identify how the conduct in failing to get permission directly interferes with the primary goals of supervision. And because the court's findings here, not whether the record as a whole or this court thinks that his 28 crimes are so serious they shouldn't have even been on probation in the first place, but what the district court's findings actually say. It's a tactical violation. I'm revoking you because you didn't get permission first, and I want to send a message to other people. This is not an analysis of the probationer's conduct relevant to the appropriate considerations that are clearly set forth in Austin and Motland.
To my listening, counsel, you seem to be focused on some of what the district court says and not all of what the district court says. Because in addition to the comments that you have repeated, the district court also says this: if Mr. Cush cannot do a simple part of probation, like getting probation permission before he leaves the state of Minnesota, then the court does not believe that Mr. Cush is able to be supervised on probation. Isn't that enough reasoning to affirm the district court's decision to revoke?
No, because that statement by the court doesn't support the factor that the court identified as the basis for revocation. They're not identifying the seriousness of the violation itself. They're making a prediction about whether Mr. Cush is likely to be compliant on supervision going forward. But that's a different analysis than whether the violation itself is so serious as required by that Austin subfactor. The violation itself, the conduct needs to be so serious. That's related to public safety. So if the court is making a generalized prediction about whether Mr. Cush is going to have a problem on future, you know, on probation going forward, that alone shouldn't be a justification to revoke if the violation conduct itself, the court hasn't identified as serious as it, you know, to correspond with the factor the court identified. So if it identifies a factor, it needs to provide facts to support the factor and the prediction that he's unlikely to be successful for not based on a minor violation, but a violation that the court identifies as technical, the court's words, not my qualitative evaluation of the violation, the court's qualitative evaluation of the violation, that directly conflicts with the seriousness
requirement. It was the characterization of the very able defense lawyer in front of the district court, though. I mean, I think if you look at the whole, you know, colloquy back and forth, it's the defense lawyer is the first one who uses the word technical, you know, which there's no problem with that's being a good defense lawyer.
And I think that
can we read into that a little bit? That I mean, obviously the judge didn't think it was technical in the sense it was insignificant, but I know you're attacking the depth of the finding, so ignore what I just said, forget it.
No, I want to respond because I do think it's important to recognize that if there's a congruence between what the defense attorney is identifying to properly characterize the severity of the violation, the district court hears that and uses the same words, the district court is adopting what the defense attorney said and evaluating the severity of the violation, which again conflicts with the requirements of the third subfactor. You identify the subfactor as serious and in the same breath say the violation isn't serious. The fact that the court is adopting the defense attorney's characterization, the qualitative evaluation of how serious this violation isn't.
Well, okay, and I think you made the point. I mean, technical contrasts with a violation that actually violates, that constitutes a new act that's illegal, right? I mean, that is one way to distinguish between a technical violation and a non-technical violation. The fact that the violation here was non-technical, meaning he didn't violate a new legal requirement, he didn't go out and commit another offense, doesn't mean it isn't serious. Right?
I mean, we also have to look at the dictionary definition of what technical means and the colloquial understanding or plain and ordinary understanding of what technical means. Technical means that it's a violation only in the strictest interpretation of what the condition says. The court is identifying also specifically the fact that he didn't get permission as why this violation is technical, because there's nothing in the record, nothing in the court's findings that identify the fact that he left the state as interfering with the express goals of probation, chiefly being rehabilitation, and public safety because he has not failed to otherwise respond to probation in any way. He's done everything that probation is asking for. It's why there's no other violations. It's why there's no other serious conduct that they've alleged that he left.
I don't know that had probation. I mean, I thought you said that he hadn't even had his first meeting with probation. So I don't know that probation had asked him to do anything at that point. And I think that's what concerned the district court, that he couldn't even do the one thing he knew he was supposed to do in terms of being on probation, and that is get permission to leave the state.
He was actually being supervised by two probation officers. So he was under supervision by his DOC agent, and he was also under supervision by the court's probation agent. So I think there's probably an element of deference to the DOC agent having day-to-day contact or whatever was required of him by the DOC. So that might explain why the probation officer set their meeting out a period of time. But we're looking at the revocation of probation based on whether he failed to respond to probation by his probation agent. I see my time's up. I'm hoping to address the second issue during rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Ragatz, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Thomas Ragatz. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondents, state of Minnesota, in this matter. Judge Barcher did not clearly abuse her broad discretion by revoking probation here because appellant, in Judge Barcher's words, tried to pull a fast one by going to Texas without permission. Oh,
Mr. Ragatz, I'm sorry for interrupting you so quickly, but is this even a legal sentence in the first instance? And I'm going to direct your attention to the career offender statute in subdivision 4, which is what we're dealing with. It talks about when the judge is imposing an executed sentence based on sentencing guidelines. So this was a stayed sentence, though. So, and I'll give you some time to think about it. And if you don't have a response now, that's fine too. But I stumbled on that word.
Well, there wasn't a stay of imposition here. It was just a stay of execution. An appellant hasn't argued that the probationary term should have been 5 years instead of 10, or that the sentence was illegal in that respect. I mean, clearly the judge could put him on probation and did, and he violated the probation. So I think that's the first point, just whether he violated probation at all, in which case the sentence gets executed. And if that happens, then you have question number two, what sentence gets executed? Do we have to remand for resentencing, which seems to be appellant's argument? But I don't think he can argue, or he certainly hasn't argued, that it's okay that I violated probation because it was an illegal sentence. And that argument doesn't fly, obviously, and it's not being made here. So the first question is just basically, Judge Barcher clearly abused her broad discretion? And it's important to remember that that's the test here. Not would this court have done the same thing, but did she clearly abuse her broad discretion in finding that this violation here was serious enough that continuing probation would unduly depreciate the seriousness of this conduct? And my argument is that she didn't, because this wasn't just a momentary lapse of judgment. This wasn't a quick side trip into Wisconsin. This was violating probation for multiple days intentionally, going as far as Texas. And this was only, as the courts pointed out, about a month into what was supposed to be 5 years of GPS monitoring and then 10 years of probation. So Judge Barcher found, if you can't even do this very simple, basic thing, ask for permission a month into probation, it's unlikely you're going to be able to follow probation for the 10 years I've required. And that does go to public safety.
But Mr. Ragatz, if I'm right, their probation hadn't really done anything yet with Mr. Cush, had it? I mean, had there been meetings that or something on is something in the record that would suggest that probation was actively supervising him at the time he left without asking for permission?
No, Your Honor. The GPS had not yet been placed on his ankle. But that is part of Judge Barcher's point here, is that he thought he could get away with it. He had this little lull where, because of a snafu, GPS hadn't been placed yet. So he thought he could duck out to Texas for a bunch of days and not get caught. So he tried to pull a fast one. And that sort of spirit is not in keeping with following 10 years worth of probation, where if you think you can get away with it, you will. And that's what she focused on here. And again, no case law.
Would you specifically address appellant's argument that that analysis that you're looking at, what you're saying right now, that focuses on permission, and that Mr. Cush did admit that this was an intentional violation. So we need something more. I mean, that's appellant's argument. This court needs something more to address the third Motlin factor.
Well, this was a serious violation, not just because it was intentional, but because of the extent of it. This, again, wasn't just, I went to Iowa for an hour, sorry. He drove all the way to Texas. He was gone for at least 3 days. We don't know how long he was in Texas. We don't know what he was doing in Texas. This, again, wasn't just some momentary lapse of judgment or he.
Well, I guess I just want to point you again to the argument that we just heard, which is, and I think it's reflected in the district court's discussion. District court didn't really focus on the fact that he was in Texas as opposed to Wisconsin. And instead, the district court focused on Mr. Cush's failure to get permission, from probation. And so how does that dovetail with the third Motlin factor, which is the only one that the district court refers to?
Right. Well, the district court clearly thought this was a serious violation. I mean, although she repeated the defense use of the word technical, I mean, she said it's like you flip me the bird by doing this. So clearly she thought it was serious. Appellant can't have it both ways here. She didn't think this was serious, and yet she was really mad and offended by it and disappointed by him. So she clearly thought this was a serious violation here. Now, I suppose you could remand for her to explain in greater depth why she thought this was so serious. That would be the extent of the possible remedy here. There's no case law that says you would ever just automatically reinstate probation. But there's no need to do that here, given the facts that were set out and that Judge Barcher acknowledged and focused on. And I think the failure to get permission here is relevant to the seriousness, because this isn't just an intentional crime. This is something that would have been so easy to avoid. I mean, if we were talking about something where it would have been taken a great effort on his part, then maybe the analysis would be slightly different. But all he has to do is pick up the phone, call his probation agent, and say that he needs to go to Texas for a family matter, and he'll be gone as little time as possible. There's nothing in the record suggests that would have been denied. So if he can't even do this easy step, that's Judge Barcher's point. That suggests that 10 years of probation is going to be too much of it for him. And it is important to remember here that he got a sweetheart deal on this case. I mean, she went along with a plea where, despite 60 burglaries or so, he got probation, even though there was a crime spree and he has 7 priors. So
why is that relevant to the question before us?
Well, I've cited on page 7 of my brief the Osborne case that says the defendant who commits a severe underlying offense is entitled to less judicial deference when violating conditions of a state sentence. So Osborne supports the notion that where you have been given such a good deal as he was here, that a judge is entitled to keep you on a slightly shorter leash. And again, we're not talking about a technical violation in that he was an hour late for his probation meeting, or he went to the wrong location, or he forgot to sign some forms. This was a multiple day, multi-state violation, since he had to cover lots of states to get to Texas. It wasn't just he made a little mistake and he fixed it as soon as he could. So, and again, the question here is, did Judge Barcher clearly abuse her broad discretion? And no case law suggests she did. No case law suggests you can only call a violation serious if it violates a criminal law or if it involves failure to attend a meeting or a rehabilitation session or something like that. Judge Barcher was entitled to consider here the serious nature of the violation and what message it would send to other probationers if she was known as a judge who would let you do something like this. You can pull a fast one. You can jump through a loophole if you find it and go to another state for a few days. There's no case law that says sending that sort of a message that if you're on probation, you better follow the conditions is inappropriate. This is totally unlike the O'Brien.
One of the arguments that appellant makes is that in a way, the district court's comments, and you're repeating many of them, is pulling a fast one, that the district court will be disrespected if revocation doesn't happen, or make this sound personal as opposed to what the third Motlin factor suggests, which is that this should be a decision that's really based on the policy underlying probation?
Well, judges are human, and she had a very human reaction here that she's entitled to have, that she was disappointed with him, given the great deal he got, that he did this. But she did talk about the seriousness of what happened here. And appellant's argument really is, well, this was the effect this might have on other probationers is not something that, that can be considered. And all he cites for that is the O'Brien case. But the O'Brien case from this court talks about a judge not considering what the press might say or what the public might think of her. That's very different than not wanting to get a reputation as a judge who gives you lots of free breaks on probation before finally revoking you, no matter how big a deal or no matter how big your violation is. No case law says that can't be considered here. And that's what her remarks went to. So the case law simply doesn't support a finding here that Judge Barger abused her, clearly abused her broad discretion, given what appellant did. And as I already said, if this court feels like she didn't lay out enough explicit facts or reasoning on the record, the remand would be, the remedy would be a remand. That's what's happened in other cases, not automatic reinstatement of probation. But given the facts here and given the key fact here that this was so little time had passed while he was actually on probation before he did this, this court should affirm Judge Barger. And I will then move on to issue number two, unless this court has more questions on the probation revocation, since appellant indicated his desire to discuss that in rebuttal. I think issue two is fairly clear. What we needed to establish here was that the present offense was a felony that was committed as part of a pattern of criminal conduct. That's what the language is. And here we have dozens of burglaries of businesses in less than a year in Ramsey County. Appellant himself admitted that these current crimes, the burglaries, formed a pattern of criminal conduct. His lawyer acknowledged the same. Judge Barger found a pattern of criminal conduct here. And no case law comes anywhere close to suggesting that dozens of burglaries in the same county of businesses within less than a year isn't enough for a pattern. And that's fairly absurd. Obviously, it's a pattern.
But doesn't the career criminal or the 609.1094 require some sort of nexus between the current offense, whether the current offense is many or one, and the prior felonies?
No, Your Honor. The prior felonies have to be sequential, and there have to be enough of them, and there's no dispute that there is. But all the language here requires, again, is, quote, part of a pattern of criminal conduct, unquote. And appellant has acknowledged that you can use uncharged conduct for that pattern. So clearly, if you can use uncharged conduct, you don't have to use prior felonies. You just have to have a pattern here. And if 30-plus burglaries in less than a year of businesses, not residents, residential units in the same county isn't enough for a pattern, I don't know what could be. So that's something everyone agreed on below. I think appellant's argument now is based on the notion that you have to involve the prior felony convictions. But again, clearly you do not, given that the case law clearly says you can use uncharged conduct for your pattern. And finally, as I pointed out in my brief, the remedy here would not be to reduce appellant's sentence. It would be to send it back so the parties can renegotiate a plea or just go back to square one. If appellant wants to be face 60 burglary charges, he can do that. And he'd likely get a significantly longer sentence, even if just a few of them were consecutive rather than concurrent as they were here. So given the facts everyone admitted here and that Judge Barger acknowledged and that appellant's attorney acknowledged and that appellant himself acknowledged that there was a pattern of all these burglaries in a short period of time, the second issue isn't really a close one. But if this court has questions on that or going back to the probation violation, I'm happy to hear them. Otherwise, I will simply ask that you affirm Judge Barger.
Seeing no questions, thank you, counsel. And Mr. Withall, you will have the last word.
Thank you for the opportunity, Your Honor. I do want to start by responding to Judge Siegel's question about the prerequisite for application of the career offender statute. First, acknowledging that this issue is not specifically raised in my brief, I do want to cite to Minnesota Statutes 244.11 subdivision 2B that gives us court authority to review, quote, whether the sentence is inconsistent with statutory requirements. Looking at the statutory requirements for 1095 sub 4, the career offender statute, the first sentence does say, whenever a person is convicted of a felony, the judge imposing an executed sentence based on the guidelines says that the career offender sentence can only apply if the judge is imposing an executed sentence as opposed to imposing any sentence. So if the court relies on the first sentence of subdivision 4 to say that the career offender statute cannot be applied to a sentence that's stayed, I think that's an appropriate reading of the law. Turning to
just to be clear, that's not an argument you've advanced and in fact would be inconsistent with the agreed to plea in district court.
Number one, I did not, Your Honor, advance that argument in my brief, but it is within the scope of appellate review under the statute, the 244 statute that I just cited. And because we are challenging the sentence is under review, and this court does have authority to review anything about the sentence, including issues that I may have missed. And second, to address Your Honor's point about the remedy first is to correct the sentence. And then, you know, the Coles case, C-O-L-E-S, talks about the state's ability to move for plea withdrawal if they were deprived the benefit of the bargain. And my client understands that the state might do that if he gets something less than the statutory maximum sentence that he did agree to on remand. And if that's the remedy that results from the district court, we acknowledge that's totally within the scope of the remand. I also want to address the pattern of criminal conduct, which I spent more time in my brief talking about. And specifically referencing the Gorman and Vicla cases, Gorman is really helpful in the sense that it identifies the scope of cases that the district court can compare for the purposes of establishing a pattern. The Gorman case expressly identifies the comparison of the current criminal conduct with prior criminal conduct. In the context of discussing whether that's limited to prior convictions, it says, no, it's not just, the decision says, no, it's not just prior convictions. It can also consider prior or previous uncharged conduct. So the line in the career offender statute is clearly the difference between cases currently before the court and cases or convictions or uncharged criminal acts that occurred in the past to determine whether there is a pattern. But no case has ever held that a pattern can be formed based on the current offenses that are before the court on sentencing. That defies the intent of the career offender statute, which is a retrospective look at the defendant's history in committing crimes or other bad acts, not whether the current offenses could have kind of shared characteristics. I think it makes sense that if the current offenses is this court is, as Your Honors have identified as part of a spree, of course have shared characteristics, but that's not what the career offender statute is looking at. Also to address the concern the state raised that Mr. Cush admitted that there was a pattern, the Vicla case, the defendant pled guilty and acknowledged that the career offender, the pattern of criminal conduct was satisfied based on his prior convictions. The Vicla court said that alone is insufficient, that it's the role of the appellate court to review whether the record actually supports the pattern of criminal conduct. And because the record in this case is devoid of any facts that could help the court identify the similarities between just the fact that Mr. Cush, yes, has prior convictions, but also the connection between the current offenses and his past offenses, more information is necessary other than just the fact of prior convictions, and therefore is insufficient to support the application of the career offender statute. So, Your Honors, we're asking this court for remand for imposition of the presumptive sentence under the guidelines and to reinstate Mr. Cush on probation. I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Right. Thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. We appreciate your briefing and argument to this court. We will take the matter under advisement.